I'd like now to introduce, joining us by telephone, Jonathan Wolf. He is president of the Fractal Foundation, and he will be leading a discussion titled Zooming to Infinity, a Fractal Adventure. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you. Now, I looked up fractal in the dictionary, and this is what I got. A geometrical or physical structure having an irregular or fragmented shape at all scales of measurement between a greatest and smallest scale, such that certain mathematical or physical properties of the structure at the as the perimeter or a curve or the flow rate in a porous medium behave as if the dimensions of the structure are greater than the spatial dimensions. Can you...
Can you help us with that? I can. That's not a bad definition, and I've spent years talking about what fractals are, and I can just spend an hour just defining the thing. And the best explanation or definition of a fractal came from a second grade girl after I spoke for about an hour explaining these things, and she said, at the end, she said, "So you mean a fractal is a never-ending pattern?" And that's exactly what it is. And that just really encapsulates it very well. And turns out that kids know all about fractals already because the natural world is full of fractals, and there are these patterns that repeat at different sizes. That's really what it is. So you can zoom into it and see more and more detail. And there's lots of examples in nature. One of my favorites is a tree. Right? If you just make it really tangible, something that you are familiar with, it's no longer so abstract and intimidating and like that. So a tree, it branches, and then each branch branches again, and then each branch branches again, and it looks pretty much the same at different scales. A little tiny piece of the tree looks like the entire thing.
And so it's the large scale and small scale mirroring each other that makes it a fractal?
Exactly. It's a different kind of symmetry. It's a symmetry that's not like a reflection in space, but it's the same shape occurring at different sizes.
So the visual beauty of fractals is really striking. What is it about them that's so appealing?
Well, there's a lot of ways to answer that question. It's a deep question, and I'm an artist as well as a scientist, and so I think about these issues a great deal. I'm very moved and inspired by the beauty of these objects and patterns, and part of the fact that we find fractals so beautiful, and just about everybody I've ever met finds fractals beautiful, and I've taught fractals to over 20,000 people now, so I haven't bumped into anybody who says, those are ugly. They are beautiful because, A, the natural world is full of fractals, and so our brains, our visual systems, have evolved over billions of years to perceive these things around us. Okay, so now we have another class of fractals, not the naturally occurring ones, but we have mathematical fractals that occur only in the computer. So basically, we can simulate these processes of nature, these repeating simple things that form fractals, and we can do that with algebraic equations, and we end up with these just incredibly beautiful, some say psychedelic patterns that you can zoom into forever. They're abstract, but they're highly symmetrical. They're very regular in certain ways, but they're interesting to the point of, well, you can spend your whole life exploring these things and keep finding new, just exquisite patterns inside them. And there's a kind of perfection there that we don't really see in the natural world. Natural fractals are a little bit messy because they have a bit of chaos thrown into them from all the environmental interactions. For example, you can take two genetically identical trees and let them grow for 100 years, and their structure won't end up being identical. Right, because of the winds and the little bugs that are eating them and the deer that are nibbling on them and so on. That all makes an impact on the structure. But the mathematical ones are pristine. So they're exactly deterministic. In other words, if you plug in the same numbers, again, you'll get the same exact fractal. And they're infinite. They're absolutely incredible. And this experience of zooming into them in... when we do it in video instead of just a static picture, pictures themselves are gorgeous. But when we take people on video zooms into fractals, like we do in the planetarium here in Albuquerque on the first Friday of every month, and we'll do tonight at the Science Cafe, zooming into fractals is a totally different experience because there you really are face-to-face with infinity. You really get the point that you're flying into this thing and it goes on forever, and that's just extraordinary. So it's deeply moving for a lot of people.
You said a few minutes ago that we evolved to perceive fractals because our bodies are full of fractal patterns themselves, like our blood vessels and so on. What is the adaptive significance in being able to perceive fractals in nature?
Well, our visual systems are fine-tuned for these kinds of fractal patterns, and it's very useful. Our brains perceive these patterns at different sizes and scales, and part of what's useful about that, well, fractals, for one thing, are often irregular, jagged, bumpy kinds of things, strange textures, interesting patterns, not the simple kinds of shapes that we, say, study in a traditional geometry class, like squares and triangles and cubes and straight lines and things like that. So if you're trying to find a predator, or if you're trying to find some prey, if you're looking for food and your prey is disguised or camouflaged in the grasses or hiding in a tree or something like that, your visual system needs to be able to see that. And so that's one ecological reason why we're very good at perceiving fractals, because we need to navigate the world around us and do all the things we need to do. And so that's why we're specialized for seeing fractals.
You used the word chaos a moment ago. What is the relationship, if there is one, between fractals and chaos theory?
Oh, very good question, and it's a very strong relationship. Basically, I'm teaching chaos theory, but I use fractals as the hook, okay? Because fractals are the pictures of chaos theory. And chaos theory sounds complex and abstract and difficult, and actually people look at me like I'm nuts when I tell them that I teach fractals and chaos theory to elementary school students. And actually, it's wonderful. The younger they are, the more they appreciate it, the more just intuitively they grasp these concepts. And chaos theory is the study of complex systems, of nonlinear dynamics, of things that don't behave predictably, and where small changes to a system can lead to big differences in the output. And fractals are the pictures of those kinds of systems, and they allow us visually to explore the behavior of these kinds of equations. If we didn't have fractals to look at, it would be all very, very abstract and difficult and pretty much impossible for most people to grasp or even to get excited about. But fractals are such a dazzling, beautiful visual hook that everybody I show them to pretty much responds with great enthusiasm and curiosity and desire to learn more about the processes that create these things. And there's lots and lots and lots of lessons that are very important for, well, just living in a complex system such as our society, our economy, our ecology. These are all complex systems, and the lessons that we teach about fractals are very applicable in all these different domains.
What are some of those lessons?
Well, the fundamental lesson of chaos theory is something we call the butterfly effect, and a lot of people have heard about this colloquially. What the butterfly effect refers to is, well, technically, mathematically, we call it sensitivity to initial conditions. And what that really refers to is that a small change to the inputs leads to a big change in the outputs, or it can. That's really what a nonlinear system means. And the way that happens is through feedback loops, okay, so that the answer, the output, feeds back into the input. And so, say, a small error in your original measurement of something will actually amplify, because each time it goes through the system, it gets a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger, and eventually the error drowns out the signal. Okay, so there's lots of applications of this. One kind of the foundation question of chaos theory is, can we predict the weather? And it was in trying to simulate weather forecasting that Ed Lorenz discovered chaos theory in the 1960s. And what it turns out is that we cannot predict the weather. It doesn't matter how powerful our computers are, doesn't matter how much data we gather. the weather is just too complex and too chaotic. And so when you hear these things like 15-day weather forecasts, they're just really a guess. And that's one illustration. But this idea of the interconnectedness of complex systems, that's really where the powerful lessons are. And I have a lot of different interests in the applications of chaos theory and fractals, and some of the things I like teaching about are the interconnectedness of ecological systems. And we cannot pretend that we can wipe out a species of some kind of living organism and that it won't have any other impact on the web of life around that, right? Because there's things that eat that organism, and there are things that were eaten by that organism. And so, and lots of other interactions, of course, but we just blithely go along extinguishing species rampantly and pretend that everything's okay, right? That it's not going to impact us.
Or introduce species into environments that they're not used to.
Exactly. That's something I wanted to bring up, which is kind of the flip side or the corollary of the butterfly effect, and that is the law of unintended consequences. And that is, you can have the best intentions and think it through really well and do something, a manipulation to a complex system where, say, you introduce, I was hearing a story on the radio yesterday about the cane toads in Australia, which are poisonous, and they're taking over. And there's lots and lots of examples of non-native species that have been introduced by well-meaning people thinking, well, this is going to solve our problems, and then it just gets out of control.
And those were introduced to solve a problem. They were supposed to eat one particular pest, and they themselves became a giant pest.
Of course. And then the problem that they have caused is much bigger, oftentimes, than the problem that they were intended to solve.
It's quite amazing that we are not able to predict the weather. We are not able to predict the effect of killing species or introducing species and many other things like that, but we are able to send satellites into space and control them perfectly in things that seem like tremendous technological achievements. The simpler, seemingly simpler things we can't do.
Well, yes, and it's an interesting analogy because celestial dynamics, right, the ability to predict the motions of the heavenly bodies. Right? This is something that has been studied for hundreds of years, and this is the classic example of predictable things in nature. These orbits are perfect, so we think, right? And so it allows us to make long-term predictions over a pretty good time scale of where a particular planet will be, say. So we send off a satellite that's going to go explore an orbit, say Jupiter, okay, and take gorgeous pictures of the moons. And I love the fact that we have the ability to pinpoint just the precision with which we can navigate to these places is incredible. But the orbits of the planets themselves are actually not predictable in a long-term time scale because there's all sorts of small little asteroids out there and gravitational anomalies, things that are pulling on the planets that we can never account for. There's actually thousands and thousands of these little asteroids around, and they don't have a very big effect, but they're like the butterflies in weather forecasting. Really, the reason we call it the butterfly effect is that a butterfly flapping its wings here in New Mexico impacts the atmosphere, and that effect doesn't just fade away. It ripples out and impacts other air molecules all over, and it keeps propagating, and it could ultimately result in a hurricane happening on the other side of the world maybe 100 years from now. And you can never make that causal link. You can't blame this particular butterfly for the hurricane, and there were, in fact, billions of other conspiring circumstances coming together that resulted in this hurricane happening. But likewise, out in space, there's all these different tiny little objects, meteors and asteroids, comets, things that are pulling on the planets. And so they actually have an impact. And what it means is that while we can predict the locations of the planets over 100 years, we can't predict the location of the planets over 1 million years. just like we can't predict the weather. We can predict the weather, rather, over 3 or 4 days, but we can't predict the weather over 10 or 15 or 20 days or a year from now.
We're talking to Jonathan Wolf. He's president of the Fractal Foundation, and he will be in Santa Fe tonight in a talk for the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, Zooming into Infinity, a Fractal Adventure. Let's talk for a moment more between the connection between fractal mathematics and art. As you said, you're a professional artist as well as a scientist. Talk more about your work and how your knowledge of math and fractals affects your work as an artist.
Certainly. I love creating beautiful patterns. Okay, I've always been an artist. And one of the things that I love teaching when I make presentations in schools, one of the really valuable things that I do is really to serve as a role model that you don't have to be either a scientist or an artist. In fact, I firmly believe that all children start out as both artists and scientists. And I have a 2.5-year-old daughter now, and she's a perfect scientist because she's exploring nature and figuring out how it works, right? She's testing the rules. And she's also an artist. She's extremely creative. And somehow in our educational system, we tend to suck out those things and replace them with rote learning and a lack of creativity. And that's one of the things I'm out to transform. So when I make a presentation, I show examples of the fractal art that I do, as well as the examples of fractal scientific research. And in my own career as an artist, the things I'm most famous for, besides the fractal zooms, which are an incredible new medium, but the things that probably most people have seen of my work are the fractal-inspired hot air balloons. So they're physically tie-dyed balloons. I call them sky dyes, like tie dyes in the sky, and they're actually the world's largest tie dyes. I make them by hand with these huge connected patterns of chains of spirals. Okay, so a spiral is one of my very favorite fractal patterns, and we find spirals in nature from the tiniest shapes up to the size of galaxies and everything in between, hurricanes and seashells, spiraling of subatomic particles and magnetic fields, all sorts of spirals out there. And so I use these patterns that our brains are finely tuned to perceive, and I build beautiful artistic patterns out of them. Now, as far as the connection between my scientific background and my artistic artistic tendencies, what I do is, well, a lot of people assume that they're not connected, but I love showing how they are connected. My scientific area of expertise is neuroscience, and in particular, visual neuroscience. So I have a PhD studying visual neurophysiology, which is to say, how does the brain represent what is going on outside in the world, in the visual world, in the firing of neurons? And we have a whole bunch of neurons, about 100 billion neurons or brain cells, and roughly half of our brain is involved in visual processing. Okay, so vision is something that I'm very interested in scientifically, and I know a great deal about how we respond to different stimuli, different colors and different color contrasts and structures and patterns and motion. And so I have a fairly good understanding of what's going on at a neural level with encoding those kinds of patterns and visual stimuli. Not that we really understand how the brain works. It is one of those great mysteries that is pretty much beyond us. But
is the brain a complex system?
The brain is the preeminent complex system. It is the most complex object that we know of. And that's why I went into neuroscience. It was the most interesting and difficult thing that I could find to study. And that's what led directly into my interest in chaos theory, complexity, and fractals, because it is a highly complex system. And what's fun about it is that it's introspectively available, meaning that we can think about it and gain some insight into how it works. And now we can probe scientifically questions that are philosophically interesting. Now, philosophers have asked questions for thousands of years about identity and perception, what it means to be me, what it means to perceive time, what it means to remember something, all these kinds of questions, but they haven't really been able to answer them in anything more than a hand-waving kind of way. But now neuroscience has tools that are allowing scientists to actually rigorously answer some of these kinds of questions, which is just fantastic. It's totally fascinating. We have these non-invasive imaging machines now that let you have your brain scanned while you're thinking about something or while you're perceiving something. And we can really gain pictures of the processes that are happening while you're aware. And so that's very, very interesting. But in my own case, what I bring to my art and my artistic creations is an understanding of how we perceive objects, and that informs how I design them, such that, for instance, a balloon is an object. It's a quite a unique art form. There are not very many balloon artists out there. There's only a couple of us. And a balloon is interesting because it's not like a painting that sits on the wall in a gallery or a museum and where people are going to be viewing it from a fixed distance in fixed lighting conditions. Well, it's stationary, stuck to the wall.
Right.
A balloon is a living thing, really. It's a dynamic organism. It floats on the atmosphere, which is the preeminent chaotic system around us. That's where chaos theory was discovered. And so every time I fly, it's a totally different, beautiful experience, unpredictable. No two flights are the same. And I don't know where my audience is going to be. Some of them might be a mile away. Some of them might be a few hundred meters away. Some of them are appreciating the art from right next to it while we're inflating on the ground and so on. And so I design the stimuli, the visual art, to be as powerfully effective at all ranges as possible. So in other words, I've optimized the contrast to be perceived at all sorts of different distances, in all different kinds of illuminating just different lighting conditions and so on, so that it's maximally beautiful for as many people in as many places as possible. And that's where the fractals come in, because spirals are beautiful at all scales. You can see them literally from miles away on the side of this balloon, or from right up close. Since it's tie-dyed, you see these beautiful details in the pleats from centimeters away, just gorgeous stuff that you can't appreciate from far away, but you see a different level of beauty at different scales.
Now, you do a lot of work with working with school children, working with young people, and I suppose given the law of the principle of unintended consequences, maybe you can't answer this, but what do you hope to achieve by showing them fractals?
Well, it is an interesting thing because it is unpredictable. You never know what kinds of seeds we're planting in the minds of young people. But I do know that some of them will plant and take root and cause huge, unpredictable things. But a little anecdote I like to share is that when I was in second grade, I was here in Albuquerque in Monta Vista Elementary School in a gifted class. And a researcher came in from the hospital, and he brought a human brain into the class to show us. And he gave us all rubber gloves and allowed us to poke it and touch it. And that made such a profound impact on me that I went off and got a PhD in neuroscience, right? And that probably wouldn't have happened the same way if not for that half-hour exposure to this thing. So I know that these kinds of things can make a lasting and powerful impact. Now, what I'm trying to do is to inspire people to learn about science and math and art. Okay, in fact, we have a saying at the Fractal Foundation that fractals are smart, and that stands for science, math, and art. And we're facing an educational crisis. It's just a really, really bad situation in this whole country, and in New Mexico, it's not doing super well in the whole country, and this whole country is not doing really well in terms of the other developed countries out there. And this is really critical, and we're not paying enough attention to it as a culture. We're not valuing education. I'm out to create a culture shift to make science and math education fun and exciting and beautiful. And we have an opportunity here with computers, because computers have, they provide a revolution in how we can teach math and science. Okay, now math is no longer something abstract, theoretical, difficult, boring, useless, all those negative things that people associate with math from, say, when you and I learned math in school, right? Algebra. Who gets excited about algebra? Well, geeks get excited about algebra, but pretty much that's it, right? Until we show fractals. Everybody loves fractals, and they're just dramatically beautiful. And so I teach fractals to kids as young as kindergartners. And by the time kids are in, say, third grade, when I teach them fractals, I'll show them the equations that generate these incredible patterns. And I get them excited about it because they want to learn more. They see the patterns in nature, they see the connections to these mathematical fractals, and they want to understand how they work and how they can make them themselves. And I have no doubt that our students in this state, in this country, are as smart as any kids in the whole world, right? So why are we failing? What's up with that? My answer to that is that it's a lack of motivation. It's a lack of interest and context and realization of the importance of these things. And I can show with fractals how math relates to nature. People care about nature. Fractals are the language of nature. People love that. They don't want to learn geometry that deals with boring abstract things like spheres and cubes and straight lines. Straight lines don't exist in nature. Nature is full of fractals. So now we have a mathematical language that describes things that people actually care about. And I want to show them that.
Well, Jonathan Wolf, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Mary Charlotte.